This is a Radio Charwell original podcast.
We love science! So sports quite
physical. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, good to sit in front of the TV all day.
No, so yeah.
And also I've done a lot of things, so I'm kind of preparing patients before surgery and taking care of them after surgery.
Wow.
And doing observations.
Science
to
what are you
going to
be a mystery? What do you think?
Healthcare, mental health, vaccines,
and science and beyond.
Welcome back to Science and Beyond. So for this week's episode, as always, I'm going to divide it into two parts, and this time it's all about strokes and stroke recovery. So for the first part, we have two really awesome guest speakers who are researchers, and you'll hear more about them in a minute. And then for the second part, I'm going to be talking to you about all the different types of strokes that there are, as well as this really new medication that is very efficient. So let's get into it.
Science and Beyond! Radio Charwell.
I'm Demi. I am a postdoctoral researcher in the group of Professor Charlotte Stack. I am in the UK for 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
I am trained in medicine in the Netherlands, and then I moved here for a DPhil in neurosciences, and I recently joined this group to learn more about studies using human participants, understanding more about stroke and how we can support stroke survivors in improving rehabilitation.
I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about what you've studied here in Oxford as part of your DPhil. Just looking at the science, and then I think we'll talk about your current kind of research and work.
So for my DPhil, I studied inhibitory neurons, particularly in a region that is involved in learning and memory, so it's the hippocampus. And inhibitory neuron means that these neurons would stop other neurons from communicating with each other. And why these particular neurons that I studied are so incredibly interesting is that we think that they guide information flow into the hippocampus. So they likely support this structure to combine and regulate information from all kinds of ongoing things around us, and all kind of sensory inputs like sounds, things we see, things we smell, all these things that we experience, all this information is coming in all at the same time, and somehow this needs to be regulated and formed into memory. And we think that these interneurons, these inhibitory neurons, play a crucial role in that. They have not been studied that well compared to the neurons that tend to store the memory. So that's what I've been focusing on in the past 4 or 5 years.
And what have you learned from your studies? And is there anything that you discovered that you didn't realize at the time before you started?
I've learned that I think these inhibitory neurons are even cooler than I thought they were. I have to admit that it was a very fundamental project, so it's hard to translate in something we could use in, for example, the clinic now. Mm-hmm. But one of the things this might be relevant to is, for example, Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. where we know that these inputs to the hippocampus are the inputs that are affected first. And interestingly, this is an input, this information stream is one of the major streams that these inhibitory neurons communicate with or drive the activity of these neurons, and therefore regulating what type of information flow crosses the hippocampus and mm-hmm. allows memory storage. So I think we laid very important ground for further research, because these neurons have not been studied extensively in the past. It's mostly the memory storing neurons that are studied very well. So although it might not be directly translate into the clinic, this is important ground for future studies that we now have shown how to record from these neurons, how to try and understand the activity in relation to other regions, and hopefully understand better how information is stored and ultimately help people that have problems or diseases that will affect memory formation. So one of the things that I'm quite happy with, things to be found, which again is quite specific and might not translate into clinic anytime soon, but about 120 years ago, there were quite a few very bright neuroanatomists, so people looking at the structure of the brain, because we did not have the tools back then to understand and record the electrical signals of the neurons themselves. And one of the, or a few of these neuroanatomists described a particular structure in the hippocampus that has sort of been forgotten over time, because it's hard to see. You need to spend a lot of time looking very carefully to the hippocampus to see the structure. Recording from these neurons in depth, we found that this original prediction that there might be a separate structure inside the hippocampus seems to be backed by the current data that we have on activity levels of neurons in this space. So we are trying to revive the idea that there's a little structure inside the hippocampus that was forgotten about in history.
Does it have a name possibly, or?
This is again very specific. So the hippocampus is built out of different regions, and within these regions there's layers, so neurons organized in a layered pattern. So this is the cornus membranous region 1, and this region is then built out of layers, and this layer is called the stratum lacunosum, which was previously grouped with another layer, the stratum molecularum. So in literature you would find it as the stratum lacunosum molecularum. And we now try to push that these two maybe do different things with different functions, and therefore might be interesting to study and important to study them separately.
They're interesting.
You were very welcome about that, because it's very specific, but that's fine. I'm just very happy with that result.
So now, since you have finished your studies and you have moved on to something else, what has been your recent role like? What are your daily tasks, and what are your, well, what is your kind of research aiming to look at and focus on?
Yeah, so I think it might be interesting to share why I jumped projects completely, because I'm doing something completely different from what I've been doing over the past 5 years in Adifa, but even before that. So one of the things that I started to miss a bit in these very fundamental preclinical questions was working with patients and people, and also eventually, I'm trained as a doctor, so I like to do research and try and improve healthcare, try hopefully to develop new treatments that work better for diseases, in particular neurological diseases, where we understand quite a bit, but there's very little we can actually cure. So this was something I would like, I liked to move back into, and Professor Jordi Stark gave me a great opportunity to just jump on this project. So I'm not the lead on this project, I'm supporting this project. And this is a project where we work with stroke survivors and try to understand brain waves that are naturally occurring in the brain during movement. We do see this in healthy volunteers. And we also know that this particular type of brain wave is affected in several types of movement disorders. So, for example, Parkinson's disease, but also is affected in stroke survivors. And the idea of the project is try to understand how this is different. There's really some research done on that, and there's clearly some differences there. And try to examine whether supporting the presence of this particular brainwave that you need to execute a movement might help stroke survivors to recover faster from motor impairments.
So are you just looking at kind of discovering what it is, or are you also looking at potential ways to kind of help them recover as well? Is it both?
Yeah, so there's the one of the more senior researchers on this project has done quite a bit of work on this already. So she has already shown that, like I said, there's quite a few differences between healthy people and stroke survivors. So the current project is recruiting. We're still recruiting. So if anyone is very interested to join the study, please let us know. But yeah, so we're recruiting stroke survivors, and we are applying a non-invasive, painless type of brain stimulation to try and boost this brain signal, this brain wave, while they're performing a particular type of movement, mm-hmm. and we try to understand whether this is helping them to move better.
Yeah.
So there's some results already, healthy volunteers, where this seems to be the case, and now at this point we're trying to study this in stroke survivors, because eventually this is supposed to be a technique or a treatment to support stroke survivors in recovering.
So do you know possibly the length of this study?
It just started, mm-hmm. So it will go on for a while. Mm-hmm. Obviously, to make sure that this is something that is actually working, we need enough participants, yeah. enough stroke survivors to test this. So again, if anyone is interested, get in touch with us. Yeah, it's hard to say how long it will go on for, but we need a decent number of participants before we can draw conclusions. And drawing proper mm-hmm. conclusions is obviously very important to be able to move on. Mm-hmm. It is quite early days, so this is not necessarily it's not a clinical trial. It's really mm-hmm. trying to understand that what we think will help stroke survivors is actually helping them, and will put us on the right track to follow up on this and try to push this forward.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do on a day-to-day basis at this point is I reach out to participants that have, I try to establish contact between participants and the research team.
Mm-hmm.
So I either reach out to participants that have been signed up to lists telling us that they might be interested in getting involved in any type of research. We try and get in touch with stroke core groups mm-hmm. to tell them about what we do and hopefully recruit people through these routes. And from there, I'm mostly involved in organizing, making sure that people are eligible for the study, so we ask them many questions to figure out whether they are eligible, and I make sure that they will be at the right time and the right place, and the researchers are at the right time and the right place, and most of the days this is what I do. Other days, when we have participants in, I will be involved in collecting the data, looking them through the sessions, explaining them what we do, what it means. And hopefully, after we collect data, I hope I might be able to be part of sharing the results with the participants as well and in the wider community.
Do you find that it is a lot more patient-focused?
Yes, I miss that for sure. Mm-hmm. I love doing science. I have to admit, it's a lot of admin now as well.
Yeah.
So if I could choose, I would definitely go for slightly more science in my day than sometimes just spending a lot of time chasing people's medical records to make sure that they're eligible mm-hmm. and it's safe for them to participate. That's one of the most important mm-hmm. things of my job, making sure it's safe for them to be part of our study. Because obviously we don't want to put any risks, given that this is a scientific endeavor rather than mm-hmm. A clinical one.
Yeah.
So sometimes the admin is challenging, but this is a crucial step for me to gain more experience in this type of research, and I'm very grateful that I get the opportunity here to do that. And eventually, I'm sure that I will be able to move back to a bit more science and hopefully more clinics for me as well, because in the end, I am trained as a doctor.
Yeah.
So, it's very enjoyable what I do now. And like I said, I'm very grateful for the opportunity I got.
That's great. One last question for you. I was wondering, how would it not be safe for a patient to participate in your studies?
So because we apply this brain stimulation, mm-hmm. we want to make sure that the brain stimulation itself would not interfere with, for example, medical devices that they might have.
Mm-hmm.
So some types of brain stimulation could interfere with pacemakers.
And
it would be very bad if we would wipe the pacemaker during brain stimulation. So these are things that we would pay attention to. Some people might have metal in their mm-hmm. brain due to accidents, surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things that we have to be very careful about. For our study, we ask people to undergo an MRI scan, and that's the same thing. So like in a hospital, it's a massive magnet. So any metals that might be affected by the magnetic field, that might not be safe for people to mm-hmm. participate. And given, again, that this is not there's no clinical reasons at this point to put them in an MRI scan, it's our study, we really want to make sure it's absolutely safe for them to participate. So these could be reasons why people can't participate. In my experience thus far, if we can chase down medical records with our team, we can examine whether, for example, let's put it this way, implants are when your devices are implanted, or when people have, for example, pins implanted after an accident, or metal mm-hmm. plates. Not necessarily a reason not to be part of the study, but we have to just check whether it's safe.
Yeah.
So we have a big team behind this, making sure that this is all possible.
That makes sense. Okay, thank you so much.
No worries.
So what's your name and what do you do?
Hi, I'm Mel. I am an associate professor in clinical neurosciences, and my research is all about trying to understand how people recover after a brain injury, particularly people who have had a stroke, and how we might be able to improve their recovery in lots of different ways.
That's great. So are there any studies that you want to talk about, studies that you are currently kind of looking into, and what have you found so far?
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of work at the moment about trying to understand how people's sleep changes after a brain injury, because we often talk to people and they say that they're tired and they're not sleeping well and they're waking up a lot during the night. And when we first started looking into this about 8 years ago, no one was really paying that much attention to people's sleep. So it was something that we really wanted to know more about. And we did quite a lot of research initially just looking at comparing people's sleep who have had a stroke to people who haven't had a stroke. And we found that whether people are in the hospital or whether they're at home, you know, many years after their stroke, many people still experience sleep problems in comparison to people who haven't had a stroke. And we know from the sort of neuroscience learning literature that sleep is really important, well, for lots of things, but one of the key things that sleep plays a role in is how we learn something new. And when you're recovering from a stroke, you're very busy relearning how to do things. And so one of our early studies, we found that people who were receiving rehabilitation in the hospital, if their sleep was more disrupted during that time, then they didn't recover as quickly or as well compared to people who were sleeping better. And so now we're doing a lot to try to better understand that, but also to figure out how we might be able to boost people's sleep.
I think you mentioned a kind of initiative that you are looking into to make patients sleep better. So what are your aims for that? And very basic question, but how can someone sleep better?
So there's lots of things people can do themselves. So there's something called sleep hygiene, which is, you know, these lifestyle and environmental things that people can easily change. It's things like making sure your room is dark and quiet and, you know, that you don't have a big cup of coffee right before you go to bed or there are things that people can do themselves, but then some people just need a bit more advice and a bit more support. So we got together a big group of people a few years ago and talked to them about how we should try and tackle sleep problems, and we sort of decided as a group that we needed one approach for people who were in the hospital and a different approach for people who were in their own homes. And we have done quite a big study where we looked at using a type of online sleep improvement program. It's called Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, which is quite a mouthful. It's an online program that has been shown to work in people who hadn't had a stroke. You work on these different things over about 6 or 8 weeks. And we did our first study where we found that people could use the program after a stroke and that it improved their perceptions of their sleep, but also it had knock-on effects to improve their mood as well. So people reported less depression and less anxiety after they improved their sleep. And we're now following that up and testing it again with people who have had a stroke, but also looking at whether we might be able to help support that movement recovery by boosting people's learning, by boosting their sleep.
Because a lot of stroke survivors are quite elderly, was it quite difficult for them to access this, or did you make kind of improvements to make it easier?
Yeah, so that was something that we were really conscious of. So the first thing we did was to give it to people to try. And we did find that some people find it harder than others, but what we provide with it is like a cheat sheet. Some extra screenshots so they know what button to click on, or just some extra suggestions to help them use the online program. And we definitely do have people, you know, in their 80s and things that are great with technology. Not everyone is, but you know, and they do seem to be able to use it. Some people have support from a family member. So we've had a few people who have had like their son or their daughter help. Some of them just their partner help them as well. So on the other side, we're looking at how we might be able to support the hospital environment. So that's a bit more tricky because you know, there's a lot of things that have to happen in hospital, particularly, you know, the nurses often have to come in and check on people during the night. And also often in a stroke rehab ward, there'll be lots of other people in the room with you. You're not on your own. So it's slightly more tricky to figure out how to improve people's sleep in that environment. But we've just got a grant to work together with people who work in stroke rehabilitation, but also people who have had a stroke and their family, to try to create some educational materials and some resources so we can help teach people about sleep and about how sleep might change after a brain injury or a stroke, and then different things that might work to help improve people's sleep. And then the idea is that we'll develop this together, and then we'll get some feedback on it from people trying it, and then we'll figure out if we can test it in the future and see if it actually works.
I think that's a really good idea, because involving family members, they'll have kind of an increased amount of awareness of this, and then maybe they can tell their friend. And then I think it's just such a good idea to kind of spread that kind of knowledge, even if it's just about sleep. And if someone hasn't had a stroke, I think it's still something really good, because we all need sleep. And
yeah, exactly. And I think we can all learn something.
Hopefully. So I was just trying to think back, because I used to work in the hospital, and a lot of my patients in the bays haven't gotten quite good sleep, especially when I worked in a ward where a few patients had dementia. That is definitely very tricky, where one in the middle of the night would wake someone else up, and then the whole bay was awake, and then it's loud, and then the whole ward is awake. So I just want to kind of look into the kind of challenges that you might have with that.
Yeah, that's a definite difficulty. And I remember talking to someone who was in the hospital at the time, and they said that they used to all go to sleep quite early, and then they would all wake up about sort of 9, 10 o'clock, and they'd have a little party on the ward, and then they'd eventually all go back to sleep. That is definitely a difficult thing, and I think it's not something that we can easily solve. But I think, I guess the better everyone is sleeping, the less they'll disrupt each other, hopefully.
Because I think it would be a bit too convenient to put everyone in a side room, because we don't have that kind of facility. But if we could, I think that'd be really good.
Yeah, it definitely does help, I think, to have. So one of the rehabilitation units that we work with here, everybody does have their own room. But they still don't sleep that well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's so interesting.
I think there's still lots of other fundamental things about having had a brain injury, but also having the nurses having to come in and check on you. And I think just, you know, your sleep patterns also change when you're in the hospital, and the food's different to what you have at home, and you eat at different times of the day, and you get woken up at different times in the morning compared to what you're used to. I think the shared rooms are definitely a problem, but they're not the only problem that we're trying to tackle. Tying into the other study that we're doing is one of the things we're hoping to also do, well, we're trying at the moment to do, is look at directly changing people's sleep. So most of our work is around, you know, those sort of environmental factors and that sort of thing. But we're also looking at whether we can use this non-invasive brain stimulation to directly target those brain waves that you have during sleep that we know are important for learning and memory. And if we can find non-invasive ways to do that, then we might be able to use that alongside rehabilitation. So we're doing a study at the moment that we're not yet working with stroke survivors. We are hoping to get them eventually, but at the moment we're trying it out on people who haven't had a stroke. One where we use a type of electrical stimulation. It's safe and it's very low level, and people don't feel it, but it is a type of electrical stimulation. And the other one where we actually play these sounds during sleep. And they're not loud enough to wake you up, but they're just enough for your brain to sense it, and it helps to boost those brain waves that we know are important.
So what do you think, if you could predict the results possibly, what do you think you can get?
so what we hope is that we can make the brain waves bigger, basically. We know that the bigger they are, the better you learn. So And we also know that in lots of conditions, such as even just when you get older, that these brain waves get a bit smaller. So we think, we hope that we can make them a bit bigger, and that then you'll remember what you learned more. So we get people to learn a task, then we get them to go to sleep, and we put these stimuli in, and then we measure their what they've learned, what they've remembered from their learning afterwards.
That's so interesting. So for the kind of, was it electrical stimulation? Yeah, I was wondering how it works, and if there's like a specific type, and like where exactly is it? All over the head? Is it like electrodes or?
So how it works? Though, I'm not a physicist, but it, basically it's a very low level of electrical current, it's essentially the same type of stimulation as what we're using for the other study.
Got it.
But you can apply it for different lengths of time. So we're applying it just for a very short space of time. So what we do is we put electrodes on the head to sense the brain activity, and then we also have some that provide the stimulation. One of the things we're looking at the moment is whether there's a particular part of the brain that's best to stimulate. So some people stimulate the front of the brain, and we're trying to also try stimulating the motor, the movement areas of the brain as well, and see if one is more effective than the other.
Science and beyond. Radio Cherwell.
So there we go. That was so interesting. And I think that stroke research is so important, especially because of the sheer number of people that are admitted into hospital with strokes each year. So that figure is around 100,000 individuals. And stroke recovery is also so, so important because it is also estimated that around 1 million people are living with the effects of strokes, and it's the fifth leading cause of disability within the UK, so it's definitely very important. Now, let's talk about the different types of strokes. So there are two main types. There is ischemic strokes and also hemorrhagic strokes. So ischemic strokes occur where a blood vessel supplying blood to the brain becomes blocked, and that accounts for around 85% of all strokes. And these blockages within the blood vessels can be caused by blood clots or thrombus forming in an artery that supplies blood to the brain, and it's often due to atherosclerosis. So I talked about this in my other video for cardiology, but it is the same principle that basically a fatty plaque builds up. And it can also be an embolic stroke, where a clot is formed somewhere else in the body, so for example the heart, and then it travels through the bloodstream to the brain. So as I said, the thrombotic one is that the blood clot already is forming in the artery that supplies the brain, whereas the embolic stroke is that it forms somewhere else in the body, often the heart. So that was for the ischemic one. It's where a blood vessel is blocked by something. And then the hemorrhagic stroke, this is where the blood vessel ruptures or bursts, and that can lead to bleeding in or around the brain. So you've got two different types of hemorrhagic strokes as well. So you have the intracerebral hemorrhage, which is bleeding within the brain, and it's often due to high pressure or an aneurysm, which is like a balloon swelling on the side of a blood vessel. And then you also have subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is where the bleeding is between the different areas of the brain and tissues, which is often caused due to the rupture of an aneurysm, so that balloon-like structure. So let me just repeat all those different ones. So ischemic is when the blood vessel is blocked, and you have two different types of ischemic. You have thrombotic or embolic, and then for the hemorrhagic, you have intracerebral, so within the brain, or the subarachnoid one, which is between different areas of the brain. But that is also something called a transient ischemic stroke attack, or TIA for short, and it's basically where one blood vessel supplying blood to the brain is blocked. And the symptoms often resolve in like a few minutes or hours, and that's quite different to a full stroke, which can last a lot longer. But it is often a warning sign that there is kind of a high risk that another TIA may occur, or even a full stroke.
And what's really interesting is that there's another condition that has quite similar symptoms to a stroke. So for example, drooping face or slurred speech. Maybe someone would ask you to smile if you're having a stroke and you can only kind of lift your face on that one side. And this kind of condition is called Bell's palsy. So it's quite similar symptoms, except the difference is that you, because when you have a stroke, one side of your body is affected, so you can't move your legs or arms. But with Bell's palsy, it is just the face. And I think that has something to do with nerves. So it's a little bit different. And people often say, for example, if you're having a stroke or a heart attack, they advise you to chew aspirin if you start having symptoms. And fun fact, they actually say to chew because it works faster than swallowing it whole, because, you know, digestion can take a little while and you don't have a whole while when you're having a medical emergency. And aspirin works because it has anti-thrombotic properties. Now, since we're on medication, let me tell you about the new medication that has been making headlines. So it's recommended by NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. And this new medication is called tenecteplase, or metalize, whichever you want to call it, but I'll call it tenecteplase. And it is an option to treat the acute ischemic strokes. So as I said, out of all the strokes that there are, around 85% is ischemic, and this is for those kind of strokes, or more so acute strokes. And research has shown that it's as effective as Alteplase, which is another drug that NICE recommends, and it's effective in breaking up or preventing blood clots from forming. And the kicker is that this new drug, tenecteplase, is actually cheaper than Alteplase. So all in the news everywhere has been saying that the NHS can save millions of pounds, and I went on the document that NICE has published around tenecteplase and Alteplase and compared the two prices, and they actually haven't released the figures yet, but I have seen that Alteplase costs just below £900, and both these two drugs are actually given intravenously, so you have like an IV line and that goes into your vein. And that's all for today. I hope that you have learned something really interesting, and as always, be on the lookout for new research that I look into and for people that I interview, because it is so fun, and I'm really glad that I get to talk to you about this. Okay, bye!